This episode of Art Intervention is dedicated to Jillian. Thanks for listening. Part 3, Soul. It is probably pretty clear at this point that I love Frida Kahlo. There is a lot to talk about, and to be totally transparent, I had a different intention for this final episode in this little mini-series, but things changed. In part 3, I wanted to talk about how Frida transcended gender and sexual norms for her time. She was known to have passionate love affairs with men, some quite a bit older than her, and women. I think that this is still an important topic to talk about, to look at how she continued to live her life as she was and love unapologetically. It is something that I might come back to in later episodes, but I felt that this emergent topic needed to be discussed first. You see, while researching the life and times of the amazing Mexican artist Frida Kahlo, I came across an article that questioned the morality of Kahlo. This article questioned whether or not Kahlo had appropriated topics, themes, and images from indigenous groups of people in Mexico. I'll be honest, it was hard to see an article like that because of what Kahlo has meant to me personally. Appropriation is a terrible thing, no matter where it is applied, but in the art world, it is a really difficult subject to get into because of the long and complex history and nature of art, art history, and artists. But remember, in the last episode, we agreed that people aren't any one thing. They are not all good, and they are not all bad. Artists are people, and people are strange and messy beings. They make gritty choices based on life events that many of us will never know about. But that does not absolve them of any kind of criticism. Look, I don't want to read bad things about the artists that I love and respect, but I owe it to the individuals and groups of people who were or are marginalized and hurt by the actions of those in power. I owe it to them to, at the very least, bear witness to the wrongs that have befallen them. They deserve to have their story told, their side listened to, and to be seen, to be heard, and to be known. No one is above being held accountable and having an honest lens cast over their actions. So, let us walk this uncomfortable path together and to begin to look deeply at the artists and art that we love, to look at ourselves and reflect on the question, when does appreciation cross into the realm of appropriation? Welcome to Art Intervention. This is part 3 of the mini-series on the amazing life and work of the Mexican artist Frida Kahlo. If you will recall from the last episode, at the end of the Mexican Revolution, there was a movement from the Mexican government to shine the light on Mexican culture, to return focus to the glory and the story of Mexico. Artists, writers, and other creative people from across the country were hired to tell the story of Mexico and her people so as to raise awareness and bring joy, making the citizens of Mexico proud. Many of the images and works that were created during this time did this very thing. They promoted and highlighted the wide range of cultures in Mexico. They retold famous folk tales and celebrated all things related to Mexican history. And so, many people reveled in this. They felt great pride for their country and for their heritage. What's problematic about that? Isn't that a good thing? Well, it's actually kind of a complicated thing. In the article, Should Frida Kahlo Be Accused of Cultural Appropriation?, writer and critic Neha Kale introduces, or reintroduces, us to Kahlo's painting, The Two Fridas. Kale does a wonderful job describing this painting in the article. If you're unfamiliar with it, you should go take a look at it right now. The painting is a juxtaposition of two seated women wearing incredibly different garments. The painting addressed the intense sadness and despair that Kahlo felt after her divorce from artist Diego Rivera in 1939. Both women in the painting are self-portraits of Kahlo. One wears a white European-style gown, while the other wears traditional clothing typically worn by the Tijuana people. Both women have their anatomically correct hearts torn open and are connected by an artery that bleeds deeply onto the white skirt of one of the Fridas. The many layers of this painting allude to the intense love and complexity that Frida felt for herself and for her newly divorced husband, Diego Rivera. It also alluded to Diego Rivera's intense love towards Mexicanada. Rivera loved the Tijuana dress worn by Kahlo in the painting, but Kahlo wasn't from that group of people who were the indigenous Zapotec women of the Isthmus of Tehuantepec in Oaxaca. If you'll recall, back in part one of this series, Kahlo was born to a Mexican woman, Mathilde Calderon, and a German immigrant, Guillermo Kahlo. In his day, Guillermo was a rather wealthy and well-known photographer.
Frida's mother
was mestizo, a term used for Mexican people who had mixed Spanish and indigenous ancestry. As Kahlo points out in the article, for Kahlo, wearing clothing associated with a particular indigenous group of people was more of a political act of support and solidarity. She felt akin to the history of the Tijuana people due to their matriarchal societal structure and their history of oppression and displacement within Mexico. Kahlo perhaps saw herself not as appropriating indigenous dress and culture, but rather was wearing these garments as an act of memory and celebration. Let's pause here to address two big questions that will help us light the way further. The first question I propose to you is, why was the push to remember and celebrate Mexican history and culture so important? And the second question, rather simply, what is appropriation? Let's talk about the history of Mexico for a few minutes, and I know what you're thinking. When was the middle-class white lady from Canada going to talk about Mexican history and appropriation? But fear not, dear listener, the time has arrived. In all seriousness, I fully understand that this whole topic can be problematic. And to be as transparent as possible, I'm including all the resources that I've used to research. I've tried to seek out different perspectives and facts when possible. But that can also be really tricky. The whole notion of history itself is really hard to talk about from a totally objective perspective. Because of the fact that as long as there's been people and people tracking history, the folks who documented history were largely the people in power. Think about how in many places, the only people who could read and write and had access to the kinds of materials that allowed the written word to be passed to generation to generation, those folks were largely the ruling and or religious class of a society. Already, you're getting a pretty biased opinion as to what happened throughout history. There's a saying that history is written by the winners, which actually seems pretty obvious. If we look at the grand timeline of human history, it's only super recently that scholars in the Western part of the world have begun to actively seek out historical perspectives from historians, scholars, and academics of color. Hell, we are just starting to see the acceptance of oral narratives, despite the fact that there are many, and I do mean many, indigenous groups of people from all over the world who have kept their histories of their people, their culture, and their land alive through the spoken word. History, and art history for sure, as an area of study or career pathway can be really intimidating because of these aspects. I move forward in this episode and all episodes with that in mind. My promise to you is that I will be transparent, listen to feedback, and will continue to learn and correct myself. So with that in mind, let's talk Mexican history. One of the oldest groups of people indigenous to what is now called Mexico were the Olmec people. The Olmec people lived around what is now the Gulf of Mexico. Later, during what is referred to as the pre-classical period, which let's question why we need to call it that term, but other indigenous groups of people that we know of today included the Maya civilization and the Zapotec civilizations. These people were amazing because they were creating dense and complex habitations at places like Calakmul and Mont Alban. This is also the time when there was a writing system developed. There was also the rise of the Teotihuacan, which gave further way to an empire built upon a fierce military and robust economy. Even though the Teotihuacan people were based out of central Mexico, their impact and influence reached out to the south where the Maya people were situated. Teotihuacan collapsed in 600 AD, which meant that there was the ability for other indigenous groups of people to emerge as the more dominant in terms of political and economic power in the region. Indigenous groups in Mexico were among the first to domesticate plant species like corn, which meant that they moved from a hunter-gatherer type lifestyle to that of farming, meaning that many groups of people no longer had to move around as much. Rather, they stayed in a single location to care for the land so as to grow their crops. This allowed for different kinds of trade to emerge. So now we're moving into a time that's known as the post-classic period, where this political spectrum was dominated by groups like the Toltec people in central Mexico. We also see the rise of the Aztec people, who in 1427 began to align themselves with the Toltecs and the Mayans. This alliance gave way to a massive empire that covered a huge portion of land between the Pacific Ocean and the Gulf Coast. But this wasn't always a peaceful alliance. Many smaller indigenous groups of people were conquered. In 1518, explorers from Europe began to make their way to the quote-unquote New World to seek out riches, trade routes, and eventually conquer and colonize the lands. The big beginning of the end for the Aztecs really began in 1519, when Hernan Cortes arrived from Spain. This dude was wild. He burnt down his own ships so that his men could not return to Europe. There was only one way forward, and it was through the Aztec Empire. Allegedly, they did receive help from other smaller indigenous groups, and for a few reasons. Some articles I found said that the Aztec Empire was so distrusted by many other groups of people that some indigenous groups wanted to support the Spanish conquistadors to bring the empire down. Others said that there was little choice in the matter as Cortes forced people into helping him and his men in their quest for gold. Cortes would eventually bring the empire down through battle and germ warfare, as the Spanish brought plague with them to the land. As a side note, there are loads of stories of the Aztec people committing ritual sacrifice and having brutal and intense warriors, but there should be just as much attention paid to the Aztec city planning and educational systems. The capital city of the empire, Tenochtitlan, had a series of aqueducts that brought clean water into the city and dirty water out. And as a result, the people who lived in the city and the city itself were very clean. By comparison, Europeans like Cortes and his men did not make a regular habit of washing in the same way. The people fell ill once Cortes and his men arrived because their immune systems were not equipped to deal with the illnesses brought by these foreign invaders. For the next 200 plus years, Mexico was under colonial rule. The land was now referred to as Nueva España, or New Spain. Most of the indigenous peoples at this time were now enslaved or dead. It is estimated that 24 million people died due to illnesses brought over from Europe. Mexico was now a global powerhouse because it served as a crossroads of sorts for people trading between Europe, Asia, and now the Americas. This is why some folks out there would refer to the current day Mexico City as the first city of the world, because it had so many different people passing through it from a very long time ago. Fast forward to 1808. Mexican insurgents were inspired by revolutions in other parts of the world, namely the French Revolution, to take back their country from foreign powers. Miguel Hidalgo y Castilla led a rebellion, and in 1810, Mexico celebrated their independence. In 1822, there was the development of the Mexican Empire, led by Agustin de Iturbide, who was the first constitutional emperor of Mexico. A revolt happened against him, and later there was a drafted Republican constitution, and Guadalupe Victoria became the first president of Mexico. Now, we get into the Mexican-American War, which came about due to land claims. The resulting conclusion of this conflict found Mexico giving up over one-third of its land to the United States. In the 1860s, Mexico was then occupied by France, which led to yet another Mexican empire, which was led by Habsburg Archduke Ferdinand Maximilian of Austria. This dude and the so-called expedition in Mexico was so unpopular and expensive at the time. There are some really great podcasts out there that go into further detail about this time frame. There is a 2011 episode of Stuff You Missed in History Class and a Noble Bloods episode from 2020 entitled Today We Leave for Mexico. Check out these podcasts, but for the time being, let's get back to our own whirlwind look at Mexican history. In 1865, after the American Civil War, French troops left Mexico. This was now a time of economic stability and prosperity. And we're also starting to get close to Frida Kahlo's time. The Mexican Revolution began when revolutionary Francisco Madero issued the Plan de San Luis Potosí, in which declared him as the rightful president of Mexico. This plan called for an armed rebellion against the current sitting government. In 1911, Madero is elected president, but conflict continued for another decade. So let's maybe leave things here. We've seen that Mexico was a country constantly in conflict, with invading and colonial presence for hundreds of years. So it's understandable why the country would be so excited to celebrate all things Mexican without foreign influences. This return and celebration of Mexican culture was called Mexicanada, and was a call to seek out identity after hundreds of years of colonial influence and conflict. Since the 1500s, when the Spanish conquistadors first arrived on the shores of Mexico, the land was fought over and the people forced into spheres of influence that drained away their lives, their culture, their land, and their true identities. Appropriation. Like I said, appropriation is a wild topic in the arts because many folks are very deeply divided on the topic. Some argue that the history of art is built on the backs of themes, concepts, images, whatever, being borrowed, copied, or stolen. Pablo Picasso was widely accredited with the saying that good artists borrow, great artists steal. Now, we're not really sure if he actually did say this. Also, I don't know that Picasso is the greatest figure in history to look at for ethical consumption or creation of artwork, but the theme of art being borrowed or copied or stolen is one that is very prevalent in the arts. In the past, art academies or craft guilds took on students or apprentices and had them copy the work of a great master. In art academies, students might have been asked to copy a painting until it was almost indistinguishable from the original. Once it was perfected, then students would be able to move on to the next style or technique. In a craft guild, apprentices were also asked to replicate a technique until it was as perfect as that of the masters. After it was perfected, apprentices would be able to actually go to job sites and support the master craftsmen, and not craftspeople at this time because all of these folks were by and large men, but support the master craftsmen as they completed the work. So the history of art and craft education stems from the concept of copying as perfectly as possible in order to become an artist or a craftsperson in their own right. But it is important to point out that at no time were these students taking credit for the work that they were copying. Let's shift the focus to that of the concept of borrowing. I might see a style of painting or a theme in a series of drawings that I love and want to incorporate into my own artwork. And this is something that, again, has had a long history in the art world. What's the problem here? Take a look at the painting Le Japonaise, a painting by the great Claude Monet from 1876. This painting is really beautiful. It depicts a blonde woman wearing a billowing red kimono that is emblazoned with the image of what appears to be a samurai warrior. The woman in the painting holds a fan open at her smiling face. Her pale skin is a remarkable contrast to the red of the kimono. So we are already seeing that there is a juxtaposition, not necessarily intentional, of a style of dress and the subject matter that is not typical of French culture. The woman in the painting was Monet's first wife, Camille Danceau. The painting depicts several themes that can be traced to illustrations from a manuscript by Charles Bergman. This manuscript was very popular at the time in France. The painting was said to have been developed by Monet due to an urgent need to procure funding, meaning he was broke. He needed money, and he was hoping that this painting would sell for a large amount of it. In 1918, years later, Monet was said to have reflected on the painting with great distaste, calling it a piece of filth. There appears to be a great deal of debate from art historians and critics as to why he might have felt that way, because his true intentions behind the painting and its themes are still yet unknown. Monet was apparently a big fan of Japanese art. He collected woodblock prints and spades, and this had some clear impact on his own art practice. And he wasn't alone. At this stage in history, people in Europe were really interested in all things Japanese. And why? Well, let's take a quick look at what was happening in Japan during this time frame. And to be totally transparent, in looking at articles for this episode, I found many folks talking about this moment in time as Japan's reopening to the world, like it was a debutante coming out to the world in some type of party. But it wasn't really like that. From 1639 to 1853, Japan was closed to the outside world, with only very few exceptions, namely Dutch traders. But even then, these Dutch traders had very limited access to parts of the country. In 1853, Commodore Perry was sent from the United States to give Japan an ultimatum to either open their ports or, you know, which again, side note, the way that this is written about in some articles is absolutely bananas. Around this time, China and England went to war because of demands that the English made did not go down well with China. In one article, the contrast between the British and the Chinese, with the Japanese and the Americans, said that Japan was much more receptive to the demands of Western envoys, which is a very nice way of saying a foreign invading power forced a decision between war and peace, and the Japanese government chose peace. What with the West being so superior and all. Seriously, it says that in some of these articles. So Japan was forced to open to trade with the rest of the world, but namely America. Suddenly, the global market was flush with goods from Japan. People went wild for these imported goods, and in France, and thus began a movement in Europe called Japonism. Artists in Europe, after 1853, began to buy up goods like fans, woodblock prints, fabric, and garments like kimonos. These objects were studied closely and began to pop up in the work of Impressionist painters and artists like Claude Monet, Edgar Degas, and Mary Cassatt. So, what's the issue here? And let's reflect back on our original question. What is the issue with appropriation, and where is that line between appropriation and plain old appreciation? Remember, one of the questions that I asked you is to consider what is the issue with appropriation and where is the line between appropriation and plain old appreciation? And it comes down to power imbalance. At the time in question here, Japan had no real choice in opening up to the rest of the world. It wasn't a collaboration between friends and equals. Rather, countries that were willing to go to war with Japan gave them the choice of sharing their goods with the world market or facing potential conflict. And then people were enamored with the idea of Japanese culture without necessarily understanding the history or the context of a lot of these goods. And so concepts and themes were being misrepresented in European art. If we want to talk even further about appropriation, consider this. If I am part of a dominant group of people and I take inspiration from a group of people who are not on equal footing, this is where the problem begins. If I then begin to take credit for this other group's work, concepts, culture, or themes, it's so problematic. And then it gets even worse if I then begin to make money off of this appropriation or become famous. So what does this mean? We can't even draw or incorporate other images, ideas, themes, or anything like that into our artwork. To be clear, that isn't what I'm saying. What I am saying here is that you can be inspired by the works of other artists and craft people from different cultural groups and communities from around the world. But I would caution people to be sure that A, we are trying as hard as possible to look at multiple informational sources that are not only credible but diverse. B, we aren't being disrespectful and copying things identically. C, taking credit, financial or otherwise, for images, themes, ideas, or concepts that are sacred to other groups of people. And D, we are seeking to find balance and power. Inspiration often comes from contemporaries, people who have equal footing. Appropriation comes from power and balance. Think when a group of individuals that have historically been subjugated or dominated by another group or community of people. And how do we do this as artists? What does this look like? We could be inspired by the colors and depictions of gardens and outdoor scenes developed by master Japanese artists, like Hokusai. But we can change things up so that the images are not verbatim of the original work. We can use the color schemes to represent concepts and themes relevant to our own lives and histories. We can pay tribute to the original artists in our statements and social media accounts so that people that deserve the credit, dead or alive, are getting it. We can also listen. If someone lets us know that we've made a misstep, we can correct ourselves publicly and seek to learn and improve in the future. Which brings us back to our original topic. Was Frida guilty of appropriating images and themes from marginalized groups of people when she wore her elaborate regalia or created her artwork? The answer is, I don't know. I don't think that this is a cut and dry situation. Like I said, appropriation in art is a tough subject. Many people do not agree, and probably never will, on what some aspects of appropriation might look like. Did she take undue credit? Or was she celebrating her country's history? I'll be honest, I don't think that it's up to me, a middle-class white lady, to make a call on whether or not Frida Kahlo was guilty of appropriation. Neha Kale points out in her article that, quote, Kahlo is part of a long history of artists who owe their artistic freedom to their power, access, and visibility. Paul Gauguin owes his simple shapes and flat forms to the visual language of Polynesia, where he spent much of his life in exile. Iconic Australian painter Margaret Preston famously borrowed Aboriginal motifs, abstracting them from context. But during a moment that asks us to overthrow age-old hierarchies, it is important that we ask questions about who gets to represent our many selves. Kahlo was a queer, disabled woman of color who used all the power she had at her disposal to fight for her place in art history. We need to give lives that are unlike hers a chance to be seen and heard, to shape the culture like she did, too. What I can say with some certainty is that how we proceed can be done in a way that is respectful and honors the work and history of artists and cultural groups from around the world. We need to ensure that we have a strong understanding of the past so that we can understand the intense damage and trauma that can be done to groups of people by taking cultural inspiration too far. But what is too far? Like I said, it's a tough topic, and one that we will need to continue to delve into here on Art Intervention. Please read the article by Kale and other authors that dive into the world of Kahlo to learn more and make your own decision. Art Intervention is researched, written, recorded, and edited by me, Alexandra Hunt. Follow us on social media at Art Intervention. And if you like the episode, don't forget to subscribe. Give it a rating and tell a friend. Remember, friends, sharing is caring. This podcast is created on the traditional territories of Treaty 7 land in southern Alberta, Canada. Art Intervention is a proud member of the Alberta Public Radio Podcast Network.